Thank you, Kendrick, for the really nice introduction. Thank you, everyone, for the invitation and having me over. I've had a great time so far, and I look forward to having another day full of really interesting conversations. And if somehow you can't make it on my schedule today, I am also around until like noon tomorrow, and then I have to go to Toronto to catch my flight. But I'm also happy to talk chat tomorrow. Feel free to email me over here if you have any questions or anything else. My talk is titled Structure Formation at the Juncture of Simulations and Perturbation Theory. And it's going to be a little bit of a smorgasbord of some work that I've done over the last few years that has been quite a lot of fun exploring two different facets of the same physical problem, which is how do we go from the very early smooth initial conditions of the beginning of the universe at the time of recombination of the CMB to the crazy nonlinear distribution of tracers that we see today. I want to highlight that I have many collaborators. I've been fortunate to have many collaborators, and it's been a ton of fun to do work with all of them. So as far as faculty goes, Tom Abell, Risa Wexler, and Martin White have been really great mentors to me over the last few years, and I've learned so much from them. I've been really lucky. I've also had the luck to collaborate with some great postdocs like Arka Banerjee, who was actually a Neil student, and I was telling Neil that I met Arka during his last few days of his PhD when I visited Illinois like 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago at this point, which is kind of unbelievable. Joe DeRose, who was sort of the elder graduate student in Risa's group when I joined and really took me under his wing and has, is now kicking me out of the nest, but it's been really fun. And then Stephen Chen, who's was a graduate student at Berkeley working with me, and who I actually also met during open houses at different places. We kept overlapping, and so it was really funny when we ended up collaborating on projects together. But I want to start this talk by giving you all a sort of panorama of what the last decade of cosmology, and really specifically cosmic survey cosmology, has been. The last decade has seen a sort of resounding confirmation of this concordance cosmological model, lambda CDM, where we have some cosmological constant driving the accelerated expansion of the universe, which might be some dark energy, but we really can't tell right now, and some dark matter component that seems to be cold. We have this just incredible suite of measurements spanning five decades in wave numbers to the largest scales probed by the CMB to really exquisite precision, down to really, really small scales as probed by surveys such as SDSS EBOS and with alignment alpha forest. And in between, we have CMB polarization, CMB lensing, galaxy clustering, which is this red LRG points, cosmic shear, which also starts to probe smaller and smaller scales. And with one simple model, we can basically put a theory line that goes through just about every single one of these points. And these are different observables from different experiments with different systematics. And this all seems to work super well. But this was the last decade. The next decade is going to really see an unprecedented increase in the statistical power of each of these measurements for each of these probes. And we can actually start to ask really precise questions about the nature of the universe. Some of the biggest ones, I think, are, what are the sum of neutrino masses, which the surveys that are probing sort of this regime here are going to be able to answer exquisitely and probably with DESI deliver the first confirmation of what the sum of neutrino masses is to some high statistical significance. What is the nature of dark energy? That is it really a cosmological constant? Does it have some sort of time evolution? Is there some scalar field dynamics that could explain what's going on as a function of redshift? As we go to higher and higher redshifts and the transition from dark matter domination to dark energy domination, we can really test this really quite well. What is the nature of cosmic inflation? That is, are the seeds that set the primordial universe Gaussian in nature or non-Gaussian in nature? And galaxy surveys are really going to probe this question quite exquisitely for at least a few classes of non-Gaussianity. And something that I'll talk a little bit more about today is, what are the nature of certain tensions that seem to have arisen between early and late universe experiments? So you might have heard of the Hubble tension or the Sigma 8 tension, which are basically the fact that these very large scale early universe experiments, like the cosmic microwave background measurements, seem to find different values for a few parameters than what we get when we measure them at late times using galaxy surveys. And so the next decade is really going to be crazy. We're going to be mapping the sky in a completely unprecedented way. This is a small panorama of all of the experiments that are going to be launching over the next decade. And these are just experiments that, this is part of the snowmass process. These are actually just DOE-related experiments in the US context. There's way more than what I'm showing here. But we're going to have, a really large amount of different probes. We're going to have the angular positions of galaxies in the sky to trace large-scale structure. We're going to be measuring their shapes to really exquisite precision. And so this is going to tell us about their intrinsic alignments and also the nature of cosmic shear, so weak gravitational lensing. Spectroscopic surveys like DESI are going to be delivering high redshift or high precision 3D radial positions and peculiar velocities of these objects. CMB lensing experiments are going to be mapping out the integrated amount of dark matter mass of the universe at extremely high precision between, you know, now and redshift 3, basically. CMB secondaries like the kinetic and thermal Sunyaev-Zhodovich effects are going to give us entirely different ways to look at the early universe. And I'm not even mentioning the fact that we have amazing results from 21 centimeter experiments coming online, like the recent cross-correlation detections with CHIME, CORD, SKA, you know, all of these different experiments. We have a large, interesting group of line intensity mapping surveys that want to look at other transitions beyond just 21 centimeter that are going to be coming online. X-ray satellites are also going to start flying and taking really high resolution views of the very high energy universe that are quite complementary to what we probe with galaxy surveys. And, you know, this is non-exhaustive. It's really crazy. And the next generation of all of these clustering and lensing surveys promise just unparalleled statistical power, unlike anything that we've ever seen before. This is a plot from the LSST Rubin Observatory year one science requirements document, where they sort of point out for a model that has a time-varying evolution for the equation of state of dark energy, when we combine all of the different probes, so galaxy clusters, strong lenses, stage three experiments, supernovae, clustering and weak lensing, you know, we can combine them all together and get really complementary, extremely tight, stringent constraints on these types of models. A quick overview of how we do this, of course. These data sets are extremely large. We, you know, LSST is going to be collecting, I think, on something on the order of a terabyte, and you know, tens of terabytes per night of data. We can't hope to analyze all of this. And so traditionally in cosmology, what we've done is taken these really large data sets and compressed them to some sort of summary statistics, some sort of, you know, compression of this data that has all the dependence on cosmology, but that we can actually analyze. So for example, in the case of the CMB, if I show you a map of density fluctuations in the really early universe, this is actually like negative temperature. So this spot, which collapses to an overdensity, is actually a cold spot in the CMB. So sorry for the color scheme being confusing. But you know, we can basically look, for example, at the correlation between two points that are separated by some angle on the sky, theta. And we can ask, oh, well, where this spot we have an overdensity, at this angular separation, do we have another spot that is also overdense similarly? And sort of scan around the sky. And we can do this for the variations in temperature. After we experience gravitational collapse, and for example, this overdensity over here collapses into this cluster of galaxies, we can ask the same question, but now with counts of galaxies in the late-time universe. And so now I'm going to be treating this delta field as this relative overdensity contrast. And so in the case of the CMB, we can also look, instead of these cross-correlations, the Fourier transform, which is this angular power spectrum. And when we look at the CMB temperature power spectrum, we're confronted with this, you know, maybe this is a plot that actually made me want to go into cosmology, absolutely beautiful, with, you know, six free parameters, we can fit this amazing, you know, acoustic structure of all of these peaks that is driving all of this early universe physics that's really quite beautiful, and get, you know, really, really, really tight, accurate fits to all of these points, which are almost all statistically independent. In galaxy surveys, it's different, but now we're in 3D. And so normally we look at correlation functions or alternatively their power spectrum, which is really the main observable that I'm going to be talking about today. But the basic idea is you can just take either these you know, correlations of points as they're separated in configuration space. And this is for a redshift space survey, so we get angular monopoles, quadrupoles, et cetera, or you can look at this in Fourier space. And this is the main type of plot that I'll be showing today, which is the plot of the power spectrum of galaxy clusters. So I said the next decade of experiments is going to be extraordinarily precise. And just how precise are we really going to be? What are the requirements that are imposed in our models? Well, if I do a small exercise of playing around with the relative sizes of error bars of different cross correlations, we can see, for example, that for the current generation, so for this Boss Galaxy Survey cross Planck CMB lensing, out to angular scales of about 35 arc minutes or L of 300, depending on your favorite units, you know, we have maybe 10-ish percent precision measurements for all of these different data points. Noise gets extremely large at smaller scales and just really blows up, and we can't actually use anything past this scale. And this corresponds for these redshifts to a wave number of about 0.2 H inverse megaparsecs. But if we now look at DESI and Simon's Observatory, Bezi autocorrelations, Bezi cross-correlations with Rubin LSST cosmic shear, we see now that out to really, really, really small scales, these measurements are incredibly precise. And another person who was a postdoc at Stanford when I started, Daniel Gruen, always said that with great statistical power comes great systematic responsibility. That is, we have now a very, very, very significant challenge, which is, are we sure that our models at these really small scales, where this gravitational collapse is extremely nonlinear and complicated, are we sure that they're actually accurate enough to do this science and really reap the benefits of all of this data that is very high signal to noise in this regime? And so just for a little bit more context, I want to show you what I mean when I say when I refer to modeling scales better. This is the expression for the angular power spectrum of sort of any observable generically, which is an integral along the line of sight of a more fundamental 3D quantity, which is the cross spectrum between two different observables. So this can be, for example, galaxy clustering, in which case you'll have two galaxy distributions here, galaxies cross CMB lensing, galaxies cross cosmic shear. And so for a few different forms of radio kernels, so for lensing, clustering, and cosmic shear in red, when we map for any given L, what are the actual 3D wave numbers that are probed by this measurement, we can see them here. And so I've separated these into three different regimes. What I call the linear to quasi-linear regime, which corresponds to large angular scales, where we can see that, this regime is pretty well modeled by our perturbation theory techniques that we have now. We're really comfortable that we can get all of the data that probes these scales. As we go to smaller and smaller scales, so after 0.25 maybe, the dark matter distribution starts to become quite nonlinear. This phenomenon of biasing, which I'll talk in great depth about soon, becomes more and more complicated, and hydrodynamics starts to have an impact into what's going on. At very, very small scales, hydrodynamics is extremely strong. Perturbation theory, there's just not really no hope because the dark matter distribution is very invalid. This is a really, really complicated regime to model and get data from, and get constraints from, so I won't discuss it. But until about K of 0.6, I'll argue in this talk that we can actually get a lot of information from this. Whereas everything so far with galaxy surveys has sort of used out to K of 0.25. And so there are two challenges that we have to solve for this next generation of surveys. As we go to larger volumes, as we go to deeper depths, as we increase our survey area, the same physical scale is measured to much higher signal to noise, right? So if we look at this plot here, these signal to noise scales where we model things quite well are much, much, much better measured in future surveys than they are right now with Bross cross Planck. But also, going to smaller scales really promises great statistical reward if we can conquer the fact that this modeling becomes much more difficult here. So let me give everyone a quick recap of what are maybe the two most famous schools of modeling this power spectrum and these large-scale structure statistics. On the one-hand side, we have now for decades a really storied history of, is there someone on Zoom?
Yeah, so when you say great statistical reward, so it isn't just, doesn't just scale as k cubed, so basically we'll be getting like 3 cubed, 27 times more. Is that how I should think about the statistical increase in statistical power?
Yeah, so it's if you look at this plot, it's sort of not exactly k cubed because there's this phenomenon of shot noise. So the number density of galaxies limits what you get out from smaller and smaller scales. If we had an infinite number density survey, we'd be a really powerful spacefaring civilization probably, but also then yes, it would scale as k cubed. So basically by going from 0.2 to 0.6, you've now convinced the DOE or your favorite funding agency that you can get, 27 times more constraining power from the same exact experiment. You just saved them several tens of billions of dollars. The story is probably not this rosy, but that is how we should be thinking about this greater statistical reward as we go to smaller scales.
Mm-hmm. I see.
One technique that's been, used for quite a while are analytic tools and mainly perturbation theories, where we try to describe this distribution of galaxies on the sky as some sort of power series expansion in orders of, and sequentially, higher and higher order contributions. So the second order density looks like two powers of the first order density, so on and so forth. And basically, there's this really cool diagrammatic language that you can then derive, which lets you relate, at any given order, what the prediction for like the power spectrum or the bispectrum is, where you can draw Feynman diagrams, compute multidimensional loop integrals, and feel really cool as you're doing all of this. On the other hand, what you can do is also super cool, in my opinion, and solve the equations of motion that you were trying to solve perturbatively here exactly using supercomputers and running n-body simulations. And this gives you this beautiful, you know, multi-phase, multi-decade in terms of physical scale, super non-linear view of the universe. And this is a the kind of image that you get out where you can see these large-scale filaments everywhere, cosmic voids showing up, large-scale overdensities and galaxy clusters. And this is an image that Ralph Kaler, who's actually a visualization scientist at CAIPAC, made in simulations with Tom. Both of these tools are great, but in different ways. So perturbation theory is, analytically tractable. It's, what's going on. You can compute these integrals to very high precision, but it will inevitably fail. So this is a figure of the power spectrum, the ratio between what you would measure in an n-body simulation and more and more complex models of perturbation theory. So the linear prediction in blue, this one-loop calculation in yellow, this in orange two-loop calculation. And we can see that at this percent level precision that these galaxy surveys demand of us in the future, after k of about 0.3, these models just don't work. And actually, recent work has shown that the three-loop contribution, the series is actually not convergent, it's only asymptotic. At three loops, you actually don't do any better than this, essentially. So it seems like there's this fundamental limitation that is redshift dependent, but maybe k of 0.3 is when our models fail to be accurate at the level of precision required for next generation surveys. Simulations, on the other hand, work really, really, really well out to quite small scales of about k of 1. This is the really nonlinear regime where substructure and sub-halo phenomena play a huge role. So even several different n-body codes trained on this or run on the same initial conditions will give wildly diverging results. But for all of these intermediate scales, n-body codes work really well. At large scales, there's this phenomenon of cosmic variance that I'll get into later that makes it a little bit more difficult to use simulations for analysis.
This one on the right, those different simulations are all collisionless simulations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really surprising. This is a very contentious plot, but I think it illustrates the point well that basically, at sort of scales that we maybe didn't think were that small, n-body simulations disagree, maybe the few percent difference. And so the power spectrum deviating at k of 1 at a few percent is really dangerous, actually. Everything that I've talked about so far in these modeling challenges is actually only related to the dark matter distribution. There's another challenge that we have to surmount, and this is the fact that while when we solve for the equations of motion in perturbation theory or run an n-body simulation, we're looking at the dark matter distribution. In the galaxy survey, we look at galaxies. And so there is some mapping, some galaxy halo connection that you have to understand really quite well for you to be able to map between this dark matter distribution and the galaxy distribution. There's a really great review article that Risa and Jeremy Tinker wrote that I recommend you read if you want to understand a little bit more what are the different approaches. But broadly, they fall into an axis where you have very physical models on the left-hand side, like hydrodynamical simulations, where you try to simulate the dark matter, you try to simulate gas at the same time, simulate star formation, simulate feedback from like supernova events, and really try to form a galaxy out of very simple initial conditions. This is really, really, really difficult and really, really, really computationally expensive. And so maybe you might want to go to models that are more and more empirically or statistically guided that still fit the data. And on the right-hand side, we have what you might have heard of as called halo occupation models, where you sort of look at the dark matter-only distribution, you look at what are halos, which are the most bound-up clumps, and then you sort of tack galaxies onto these halos in some statistical sense. And this actually also works extremely well. But is not as physically inspired as maybe these hydrodynamical simulations. These are all simulation-based approaches. What you could also imagine doing is staring at these two figures here and thinking, gee, they really look very heavily correlated and similar. Maybe there's a purely mathematical perturbative description that I can write down to relate the two. And so then we enter this realm of what's called the bias expansion, which is an ansatz, basically, that the relationship between the galaxy distribution and the dark matter distribution is actually really quite heavily constrained. It's some basically non-local functional Taylor series of only things that are constrained by the equations of motion of galaxy formation, which are basically Newton's laws and the fluid dynamical equations. So you need things that are translation invariant, things that are rotationally invariant, things that are invariant under the boosts. These are the only things that you can write down. And when you couple this with the equivalence principle, you find actually that this functional can only depend on Hessians of the gravitational potential that sets Poisson's equation. So it's, you know, powers of this Hessian and higher derivatives. And so when you make this expansion in full generality, you lead to what's called an effective field theory of biasing. And so this has, you know, quite a few advantages. It's very general. It's, you know, quite rigorous. You can fully specify the shape of this functional at any order just by the symmetries of the problem. If you want to add additional physics, such as the effects of primordial non-Gaussianity, some people are really interested in the early universe and supersonic differences in velocities between baryons and dark matter fluids, the effect of massive neutrinos on structure formation. You can just augment this functional and find out what those contributions look like. On the other hand, this is a perturbative expansion, some sort of series expansion, and so it is going to have a limited regime of applicability, like the dark matter perturbation theory that I was discussing before. And so let me mathematically show you what a bias expansion would look like in one of its formulations and to second order specifically. And so imagine that we go all the way back to the very early universe, and we're looking at just patches of the CMB in these Lagrangian coordinates that I'm calling Q. This distribution is actually really quite smooth. And so if we expand this, the trace of this Hessian is just the Poisson equation. And so this will give us something that looks like the density field. And we have some free coefficient, which is basically the derivative of this functional with the density. We can, of course, have the second order expansion of this trace, which will give us this density field squared. This is some normalization condition that you have to subtract out the variance of the field. The traceless part of this Hessian gives you the tidal field, but that's a tensor, so you have to contract it with itself. So you get something that looks like the tidal field strength squared. This is also an expansion in derivatives, and so you have a first a higher derivative contribution, which is what looks like a finite size correction. So the fact that, you know, these Lagrangian patches that you have some smoothing scale over, you have to control for the curvature of these. And then, you know, there are higher order contributions that I'm neglecting, and also there's some this is a deterministic relation, but really the process of galaxy formation is sort of random. It depends on really, really, really small scale, really, really, really weird physics that we can't possibly hope to handle perturbatively. And so we include some form of a stochastic contribution, which is trying to encode the impact of these really, really, really nonlinear scales.
Sorry, what is that finite size effective correction?
Yeah, so this is basically, if you can also expand this F not just in powers of this functional, but higher derivative contributions. And so, for example, what looks like the higher derivative contribution of the trace of this is this Laplacian of the potential. Now, you can't just have a gradient of the potential because that's not rotationally invariant because it carries an index. So the first thing that you can write down is this Laplacian contribution. You can also imagine this as some sort of biasing related to the curvature of peaks of the distribution in the very early universe. Because if you were to write down something that looks like the Laplacian, if these are peaks, or sorry, the gradient, if these were peaks, they would be zero because you're at peaks anyway.
And so for all of this, you know, so are you neglecting the possibility of things like isocurvature fluctuations?
Yeah, exactly. So this is assuming that isocurvature fluctuations are very small. You can extend this picture to like a two-fluid picture where you have baryons and dark matter, and you have an adiabatic mode, which is what this expansion would be, and an isocurvature mode. And the picture, this doesn't change that much. And it turns out that the corrections that you get are very small and quite degenerate with, like, for example, this higher curvature counterterm here. I can point you to a paper that works this up. Do you have any other questions? Okay. If not, then I do want to point something out, though. Simulations, or these analytic approaches that I've been telling you about, are really trying to describe the same physics, right? They're both trying to describe what's happening in the universe when you have particles at some initial position, and they'll move around under the force of gravity to some late time position, and related to this displacement, effectively. When you solve for the equations of motion in perturbation theory or in n-body simulations, this is the phenomenon that you're trying to capture, the motions of particles, of fluid elements across time. And so if you were to write down a perturbation theory for these displacements, or look at an n-body simulation, you're really solving for the same exact quantities. So why do we treat them as two distinct approaches that are, you know, sort of siloed off and shouldn't talk to each other? And this question led to a really interesting proposal from Martin White's group back in late 2019, early 2020. That biasing formula is really quite simple, and the perturbation breaks down quite quickly. Is there a way that we can combine, let perturbation theory inform the form of this biasing functional, and use the displacements from simulations? And so can we combine perturbation theory and the simulations in a sort of useful way? These models, you might find in the literature under this buzzword, hybrid effective field theory, or HEFT. Someone coined it that. It wasn't me. The name kind of stuck. So, you know, apparently, if you give a talk to particle physicists, they'll tell you HEFT is reserved for Higgs effective field theory, which I didn't know. So I won't say HEFT, but if you see that showing up in cosmology, this might be what it means. And so let's go back and look at that biasing expansion, but at the level of a simulation. This is that same panel that I had showed you earlier from the initial conditions of the simulation. So this is the initial density field of that simulation. I can build this next order operator, which is squaring the density field. And we can see that what we're doing is picking out, for example, this very large overdensity and highlighting it, taking this very large underdensity over here, also highlighting it, and suppressing sort of everything else. This tidal field strength picture is a bit more complicated, but if you stare very deeply, you might find some like filaments being picked out. Like, for example, maybe this filamentary underdensity here gets picked out over here. Maybe my eye is playing tricks on me and I'm trying to describe this plot to you in some way. In any case, you can build this expansion in a simulation, build all of these operators, run your simulation, and ask, how do the particles that were at several different points in time spread across this across these fields, what do they look like at later times? And so if I run my n-body simulation, I get this late time distribution of particles, which gives me the density field of matter. If I now take all of those particles and I just weigh them by what their local density was at the initial conditions, or their local density squared was, or their local tidal field squared was, these are the same exact particles, but now all of a sudden we're getting a different multi-phase view of the formation of structures. We can see that maybe by weighting by the density, we're upweighting these higher density regions. Weighting by the density squared really picks out the super high density regions, but then also really picks out the voids for some reason. They seem to all of a sudden stick out. We see strong filamentary structures running across the tidal field contribution. And so we can just generate these in our n-body simulation by just using the same exact particles, but moving them painted by a different color or weighted by a different value. And then we can ask the question of, what happens if I measure summary statistics of each of these fields? If I measure the power spectrum between this panel over here and this panel over here, and vice versa.
And just to clarify for me, so delta here, does that correspond to the Lagrangian or the Eulerian?
This is the Lagrange, weighted by the Lagrangian field.
And delta squared and S squared, these are all
Lagrangian, yeah. Yeah, so what I'm showing you here is like the Eulerian result of moving the Lagrangian weight fields at very early times. So if you didn't weigh at all and just move particles, that gives you the density field. If you start weighing them in different ways, you start picking out these different operators, which I've called, you know, O delta, O delta squared, et cetera. And what this bias expansion states is that any distribution of a tracer, if it's rotationally symmetric, you know, translation invariant, et cetera, can just be described by a very simple, you know, linear combination of some free coefficients times these late time fields. And so the question is, how well does this work? At the level of summary statistics, we can measure this panel of all the different cross correlations. So this is the matter power spectrum, matter cross this density weighted panel cross correlation, density squared, tidal field squared. And what I'm showing you in the solid lines are the measurements from the simulation based result at different redshifts. And in the dashed lines are the result of this one loop perturbation theory result calculation. And what we see basically is that at very large scales, these summary statistics are entirely consistent with each other. And so this model, you know, as your scales are more and more linear, reverts back to perturbation theory, this hybrid scheme. But at small scales, they have this increase in power. They actually capture the nonlinear structure formation quite well. And so you can then build a model for the halo-halo or tracer-tracer correlation, the tracer-matter cross correlation, by just summing across each of these spectra multiplied by the appropriate coefficients. So for example, this term here, this delta delta squared spectrum, which is weighed by V1, V2, would be this shape over here. And the fact that at large scales, we get entirely consistent results with perturbation theory means that if you're analyzing a survey using perturbation theory at large scales, for example, for redshift space distortions, but then you have small scale lensing, which is really difficult to deal with, you can just use the same exact free parameters and combine them, which is something that I'll show very shortly.
So I'm a bit confused with this on the other and the Gaussian business, because I mean, the things on the right hand side are presumably from the Lagrangian. On the left, it's Eulerian. So I don't know how that works.
So everything here now is a Lagrangian.
But what we observe is an Eulerian quark, like this.
Yeah. And so basically, when you shift all of these fields from their Lagrangian coordinates to their Eulerian coordinates, you get these different panels and these different operators now. So these are like shifted Lagrangian operators, where I took the Lagrangian operator and moved everything according to its nonlinear displacements to late times.
Right, so these are all Lagrangian, but if I make an observation, I make it an Eulerian.
But this is an Eulerian picture, right? This is a late time matter density distribution in configuration space, and same for all of these.
Yeah, but for the next page.
Yeah.
These equations. So presumably, what I observe is halo power spectrum in Eulerian coordinates.
Yeah, but these are all Eulerian correlators now that are computed in Lagrangian theory. So I can.
Okay.
Offline, I can sketch you the calculation, what this looks like.
Just to make sure that I'm also...
Yeah.
So what you've done this is to, measure these Lagrangian fields, and then you then use the simulation then to nonlinearly affect those fields.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so if you were doing Lagrangian perturbation theory, you would have these Lagrangian fields with some statistical description. You would use Lagrangian perturbative displacements to move them to late times, and then you would compute the correlator of what happens when you move everything to a late time to get the Eulerian final result. So maybe just very quickly, basically the sort of structure that you get for this kind of calculation is a very nasty kind of thing where you have some expectation value of the two Lagrangian operators, but then you're shifting them by this displacement field. And so you have to evaluate this very complicated correlator structure analytically. But then basically what we're doing with the simulation is just letting the simulation do this integral for us to all orders.
Shouldn't there be some correlations of delta with other fields on the right hand side in this equation?
Some correlators of delta, you said?
Yeah, the delta. So that's displacement between a Eulerian?
No, so you can always, so for any correlator, you can always use Lagrangian perturbation theory to re-express. So if you expand this as, some thing like this, you can always relate these back to the density field. And we're just letting the simulation do this complicated correlator for us, basically. So basically, if we look at this combined model now, we find that it's really quite better than the sum of its parts. So this is a very busy plot, but let me walk you through it. We can, for example, look at halo catalogs of varying masses. We can look at assembly bias in concentration or in spin, which is a very theoretically difficult phenomenon to model. And we can jointly fit with those four free parameters the halo-halo and the halo-matter cross-spectrum, for example. And we basically find for all of these panels, all of the fits that we do, that to K of about 0.6, we're within 1% precision. And so if the previous state of the art was 0.2, 0.3, this is a tremendous improvement of what we could do with the same sort of parameterization. We also took some fitting formulas for baryonic effects, which is this curve in blue. We looked at the standard sort of EFT description that people had used for the effects of baryons, which is a Taylor series, basically. And also looked at the shape from this contribution from higher curvature, from the curvature of the peaks, which also captures the effects of baryons. And this is, within 1% out to K of 1, actually, once you tune this coefficient, which is really quite powerful. So this combination seems to be extremely good as a model for galaxy surveys and their cross-correlations. But this is simulation-based. And so you still have this issue that you ran one simulation at one cosmology, but obviously that's not the one that your universe is in. Yeah. So we played this game of emulation where we took a suite of 40 n-body simulations that tile this WMAP plus Planck parameter space for WCDM. Joe, as part of his PhD thesis, ran this emulous alpha suite. So these are 40 cosmologies at 10 redshifts. You can measure all of those basis functions in that triangle plot as a function of cosmology, as a function of redshift, and use some, you know, statistical regression tools to figure out what this dependence is, assuming it's relatively smooth as a function of cosmology and redshift. And so this is this code that we wrote on Zoo, which is not named after Andrzej Slosar. He gave me a lot of crap for this, but it was completely coincidental, which is a code for the cosmology dependence of these hybrid EFT spectra for clustering and lensing modeling. And what we showed in our first result is that actually, we can use this model for parameter inference. And so we built this emulator. We took a completely different n-body simulation, an HOD sample from HALOS at a completely different redshift than anything that we had. And we basically find that we, using PGG and PGM, we can recover the cosmology for omega matter and sigma 8 and H naught in an unbiased way, going down to k of 0.6, with, you know, improvements in cosmological constraining power as we go to smaller and smaller scales. Naively, if you do this k to the cube scaling that I mentioned, which doesn't actually hold, but for the sake of argument, let's say, you would get a five-fold reduction in your error bars from going from k-max 0.2 to 0.6. So if you could actually do this, this would be sweet. And so after we wrote this paper, we were really excited by these models, and we were asking several, oh, sorry, Matt?
Finish your sentence, go ahead.
And you know, there were several different questions that we started to ask. You know, what could we do with this sort of picture where we're combining perturbation theory and n-body simulations? And yeah.
So, which of the bias parameters are most sensitive to the cosmological parameter? Like, how sensitive are the bias parameters to those cosmological parameters? Is there one that is most important in getting extra information from these nonlinear scales, or they're all equally important?
B1, B2, and this Laplacian term are all really important. The tidal bias, this BS, it's very unconstrained, basically. We have very weak constraints on it. It's also, I was talking to Kendrick, we later realized it's maybe not the best parametrization of these tidal field effects, and I think if I were to revisit this paper, I would use a slightly different one. But we find that if you remove any of, like, B2 or B nabla, you just get totally biased constraints in cosmology. And so you actually, you know, it's not like you're just wiggling, you're not fitting an elephant and then wiggling its trunk with an extra one. You really need all of this, you actually need all of this freedom to be able to capture these small scale modes.
I think I have a basic confusion that I just want to clear up. So, so you do these simulations in order to measure what these bias parameters are in different cosmologies? These are free parameters
no,
marginalizing over.
Yeah, so the biases are free parameters that we marginalize over. What we use the simulations to measure are the cosmology dependence of each of these basis functions. And so then we're basically saying that any sort of observable can be represented by a quadratic form, basically, of these basis functions and appropriate coefficients. And so this has cosmology dependence. These we let float. And we self-calibrate them using the simulation.
Okay, and while you're on this plot, so how do I know that the simulations are well described by these bases? It's the agreement between the dashed and the solid lines?
Right. So the agreement between dashed and solid lines at large scales just means that we're not, like, wildly inconsistent with perturbation theory, which we think is correct at those scales. I think these sorts of tests, where we can fit these samples to very, very high accuracy at small scales, are what we use. And then the fact that when we throw, you know, something...
The thing is that there are some values for these bias parameters that give you a good fit.
Yeah, exactly. Which in principle are the bias parameters of this tracer population in the early universe. So for example, when we varied this assembly bias parameter in concentration, we looked at how were these Bs changing? And there are other measurements of this in the literature. And so for this linear bias B1, this is really quite well measured what the concentration variation is, and what we find is really consistent with that. And we can also measure the response, which of these changes more or less. And this is sort of a sanity check that we're agreeing with previous studies. But yeah, there's no ab initio calculation that you could do for these bias parameters to tell you that you know what the result is. Because if we did, we would have solved galaxy formation, essentially.
Well, but you know them in the simulations because you had to find the best fit values to make these plots, right?
No, yeah, right. But this is we're floating them in a fit, right? So, for every population of tracers, if they don't have some crazy thing that breaks like Galilean symmetry, this parameterization should be sufficient. And then we just find the coefficients that describe this. There are models where actually it looks like the higher order tracers, where the higher order corrections might also be important, but we didn't find this for these halo masses, basically.
All right, thanks. So can you go forward?
Here?
Yeah, so you don't show the degeneracy of B2 and the BS, so those guys with the parameters, right? Isn't that?
Yeah,
you want to show that?
It's in the paper, okay. But if I put this plot here, then the text is really tiny, or it's like really squeezed. I'm not a fan of showing squeezed triangle plots.
But I guess the point I wanted to get from that is that they're degenerate with the pathological parameters. So if you set them to zero, you get the wrong value, right? Because for B1, I don't see that.
Well, there's a very slight degeneracy with B1 and sigma 8, for example, but we kind of break this from the fact that we have lensing, like the G matter and the GG correlation. So you can break this degeneracy.
But for other parameters, is it more significant degeneracy that zero?
Yeah, I can show you the plots later when we meet. I'm not going too hot on time, but.
To measure these bias parameters, so are you fitting at the field level, or
this is at the power spectrum level? Yeah, and I'll get back to this. So we started asking many, many, many questions, but some of the ones that I can at least give you some initial answers to today are, we were wondering, well, okay, we have these models. How do cosmic surveys actually benefit from their use? How can we understand the galaxy-halo connection with these models? Because now you have this very general parameterization of the galaxy-halo connection, where you've abstracted away the complication of dark matter evolution. So this seems like you could somehow make a statement about, how do you connect dark matter to galaxies when you don't have to deal with the problem of dark matter being very difficult to model? And finally, are there other cute tricks, novel directions that we could play where we can combine simulations and perturbation theory? So for this first one, I just wanted to point out an analysis that Steven led, but that I think was really, really, really cool, where we basically combined large-scale BAO measurements and redshift space distortion measurements that we described purely in perturbation theory. So these are SDSS redshift space distortion measurements, full shape, out to k of 0.2. The correlation function only measured around this BAO region at very large scales. And we also included cross correlations with CMB lensing, which probes significantly smaller scales than the clustering. And basically what we find is that just using the perturbation theory to describe the redshift space distortions, which we can't do with these hybrid models for now, but then letting the fact that they use the same exact three parameters biases to analyze the CMB lensing to smaller scales, we basically get a new paradigm of constraints where you have a cross-correlation between a 3D survey and a 2D survey with a very strong small-scale lever arm from the fact that you're looking at smaller and smaller scales. And this lets you self-calibrate all of these bias parameters to very high precision. Unfortunately, when we did this analysis, we actually found that Planck CMB lensing maps are just way too noisy to actually gain anything from those smaller scales, which is that plot that I showed you right at the start where the error bar just blows up after k of 0.2. But surveys like ACT and Simons Observatory are going to start probing these scales really, really, really well. And BOSS also was an issue, but DESI is right around the corner. There are also similar gains that we could have from looking at these 3D plus 3x2 point analyses of DESI and like Cosmic Shear, for example. And Cosmic Shear probes significantly smaller scales than CMB lensing. So I think this is a really interesting avenue that we could look at. And I think these sorts of analyses will really start to weigh in on the SA tension. Even this purely perturbation theory analysis What we found was these two points here, that basically when we add this CMB lensing cross-correlation, we shift sigma 8 down, or S8, to quite small values. We actually, I think, have the lowest S8 measurement on record. It's actually due to systematics, but you know, I can tell you more about that. But you know, it does weigh in on the fact that all of these different measurements from, for example, cosmic shear surveys, cross correlations with clustering, CMB lensing cross galaxy clustering, 5 by 2 point cross correlations, they all seem to find quite low values for this S8 compared to what we get from CMB measurements of polarization and temperature and isotropies. The other thing that we were wondering is, if this is this really nonlinear model, can we actually go beyond this two-point paradigm? You know, for non-Gaussian fields like this distribution of galaxies, this two-point paradigm just doesn't capture all of the information. At least you can agree with me that this density field has some sort of a skewness beyond just having variance. And the skewness, for example, would be captured by the three-point function, where you're counting triangles, and the triangle configuration that you look at traces different phases of the density field. But part of the problem with beyond two-point analyses is that they're just a really large number of statistics, and they get really complicated, and it's not clear if this hierarchy of correlation functions is the way to go for very nonlinear fields. So one thing that people have done for almost 100 years now is actually looking at counts in cells as a statistic. So basically, these endpoint functions are probing moments of this underlying distribution of galaxies. And so the question is, can we actually just probe this PDF directly? What is the probability of, you know, the PDF of galaxy densities smooth on some scale? And so if you just look at the histogram of galaxy densities in your survey, people also call these counts in cells, which I'll be representing by this P of k given V. So what is the probability that if I plop down a cell of volume V in space, I'm going to count k galaxies inside? And, you know, there's a lot of excitement about this in the literature, but literally Hubble in 1934, when he made his first extragalactic catalog of objects, made a counts in cells analysis and fit a log normal to it. And, you know, in DES until a few years ago, we were still using log normal distributions to model the density field. So, you know, it's been 100 years and we haven't really gone past that paradigm. And counts in cells are actually really interesting because you can actually connect them to correlation functions in a very interesting way. So this dates back to a paper by Simon White from 1979, where he wrote down a generating function description of the counts in cells probability function. And he basically showed this is a very, very ugly expression. But the end result is that for any given kth count in cell, you're actually probing sort of k derivatives of some integral over a sum that's of the exponential of all endpoint correlation functions. So this information is there in a really complicated way. And so with Arka Banerjee and Tom Abell, what we looked at were counts in cell statistics, or a cousin of them, called k-nearest neighbor cumulative distribution functions. These are mathematically exactly the same thing, but these k-nearest neighbors are really easy to measure in simulations. And basically what we found is that if you use a hybrid EFT description to model these k-nearest neighbors, so if you fit your bias parameters to the power spectrum and then measure the corresponding k-nearest neighbor distribution, you can actually self-consistently describe both of them. And so what I'm showing you here are residuals given statistical uncertainties for for the first, second, third, and this joint k-nearest neighbor distribution as a function of basically the radius of your cell. And what we find is a really, really, really good fit until some sort of scale where these models break down. But this is implicitly saying that with these hybrid EFT models, we can actually probably describe all endpoint functions using self-consistent coefficients between the two. I can tell you some more about the differences between these two points, but the point is these solid lines are self-consistent power spectra and KNNs. And the fact that they're self-consistent means that you could imagine analyzing both of them together in a galaxy survey using these same pre-parameters. And basically, when you combine power spectra with KNN statistics, you really, really, really tightly sharpen your constraints on these bias parameters. But you actually also improve quite a bit the measurements of like omega matter and sigma 8. So this figure of merit, the determinant of this of the matrix that describes these contours, shrinks by about a factor of 4 almost, or the square root of the determinant. And so, you know, a follow-up that we were thinking is, okay, maybe these k-nearest neighbor statistics are a bit bespoke, they're not ready for an analysis, but we know we can fit three-point and four-point functions. And so if we were to build these hybrid models for the bispectrum or the trispectrum, how well could we actually do, and how could we get them survey-ready? Something else that we looked at was how can we understand this galaxy-halo connection a little bit better with these models? And the reason is because bias expansions are very interesting, but as we've entered this era of precision cosmology, they've gotten more and more unwieldy to work.
Question here.
Yeah?
When you go to higher point functions, don't you need to add higher biases?
Good.
Delta Q, delta force, and so on?
Good. In the Lagrangian picture, having a Lagrangian B1 generates all order Eulerian contributions, basically. So like if you have a Lagrangian B1, you generate an Eulerian B2, and you generate an Eulerian B3. So the fact that we're using some Lagrangian biasing scheme means that we do have, in some way, captured part of the higher order Eulerian contribution. And it seems like we're able to, you know, it's unclear. I mean, we do want to revisit this analysis with, for example, the cubic basis and see what smaller scales we could push to. But it seems like we're capturing them well enough to some extent.
Well, yeah, you capture some part of it, but perhaps not all, right?
Yes.
You have to add all other, right?
Yeah, we definitely, I mean, I think I would only trust the bispectrum analysis of this if we show that the impact of adding, for example, the cubic contributions is not, you know, extraordinarily significant compared to what we had when we had the second order, to make sure that there's some convergence in this expansion.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Right. Going back to challenges with bias models. So there was this really technically impressive paper that Oliver Philcox led recently, where they analyze the one loop bispectrum purely in perturbation theory in redshift space. And basically what they find is that there are 44 free parameters which show up in their model that are bias-like parameters. And unless you have really, really, really well-motivated priors from simulations, the fact that you have this horrendous parametrization really kills your constraining power. The purple ones are parameters that show up for both the power spectrum and the bispectrum. Blue ones are power spectrum only, and black ones are bispectrum only. So this is, you know, a bummer. Something else that people have noted recently is that as we start to probe primordial Gaussianity better and better with galaxy surveys, it actually turns out that the signature of this quadratic bias, the B2, is very degenerate with the signature of non-local primordial non-Gaussianity. And so basically this affects this bispectrum. If you vary B2, this is what the shape looks like for a modest shift. And if you sort of stare by eye, the shape of the variation, so this orange, this red and blue curves, they're actually really quite similar. So unless you have a very good measurement of B2 from somewhere, you won't be able to measure this primordial non-Gaussianity. Something else that's recently been pointed out is that a really key assumption about galaxy formation and local primordial non-Gaussianity has actually been shown to not hold at the accuracy needed for DESI and more. And so if you look at the snowmass forecast for primordial non-Gaussianity, for example, they all assume that this B5 parameter is related to this B1 parameter by this solid black line. There's results, for example, looking at recently accreted halos, and this was already known to be different even back in 2008. And people have recently started to investigate this using galaxy formation simulations and find that, you know, for total mass bins, stellar mass bins, neutral hydrogen distributions, or quasars, this B1, B5 relation can sort of be all over this place and not actually just constrained to this line. So this is another significant source of theoretical uncertainty if we want to measure primordial non-Gaussianity. However, hybrid tools can actually sharpen this picture. So in another paper, what we looked at were a derivation of some techniques that you can basically measure these B1s and B2s in galaxy formation simulations at really high precision using field level. And so I'm just sort of showing this here. And we use these to actually really precisely measure all of that set of biases for example, DESI luminous red galaxies. But this can be extended to any other technique. This was just a DESI-focused paper. And so if you have realistic simulated populations of these galaxies, like LRGs, ELGs, Lyman-Brake galaxies, and quasars, you can actually get, you know, really informed priors for galaxy surveys and help break some of those degeneracies that I was talking about earlier. These techniques are also sort of directly applicable to looking at this response of galaxy formation to primordial non-Gaussianity, which is the last plot that I mentioned. And just an example of what these hybrid techniques might look like, this is another paper. I didn't write this one, but I like this figure a lot, where they basically look at halos from an n-body simulation and show how the field level distribution looks as you sort of go from this standard linear bias prescription to something that is a more complicated nonlinear bias. And this sort of field level picture is exactly what I think is the way to go. finally, and I'm actually out of time, so I'm not going to be able to talk about this too much, is what are some novel directions where simulations and perturbation theory can be combined? And basically, one thing that we noticed is that simulation-based analyses at large scales have a lot of uncertainty. This is what's called cosmic variance. This plot for this paper, you know, for most of these panels, I conveniently cut it off before the cosmic variance becomes really ugly. So that's why you don't see them here. But if you look at a paper that extends to larger and larger scales, you can actually see there's a huge scatter. So if you want to use simulation-based models to analyze data, you have to be really careful with your large-scale measurements. And so there's this principle in statistics called control variance, where we basically ask, oh, let's say I want to measure a very noisy quantity, like the power spectrum in a simulation, but I can produce a really cheap correlated surrogate. Then you can define this new estimator, which is a linear combination of the two, with a Lagrange multiplier, and you have to know the mean of this cheap correlated surrogate extremely well. And you can basically find that for the Lagrange multiplier that minimizes the variance of this new estimator, you get a very, very, very dramatic reduction in the variance of your quantity as long as they're deeply correlated with each other. In cosmology, people have called this the carpool technique. It was introduced by Ben Wandelt and one of his students, where they use approximate n-body solvers like COLA or FastPM. But this technique actually has substantial computational requirements. Basically, in the context of DESI, they tried to use this technique to reduce the variance of their n-body simulations and burn something like 24 million CPU hours, which, if you're not in supercomputing, let me tell you, that's a really, really, really large amount of CPU hours for a single project. And so what we were wondering is there a control variate that is analytically tractable so we can get this mean really well, but that also correlates strongly with the nonlinear distribution of dark matter? And the answer is that we go back to 1979 and look at the simplest model for structure formation, the Zadovich approximation, where basically you could just imagine that you have some sort of homogeneous distribution of particles or some light rays, for example, going in, and they're scattered by some initial perturbation, some the fluctuations at the surface of last scattering, and then they don't suffer any more gravity. There's one gravitational kick, and then they just move in straight lines. So this is very similar to a picture of geometric optics if you have some sort of corrugated lens scattering parallel light rays going in. And while this might be really, really simple and stupid sounding, this is an incredibly insightful model for the formation of structures. So for example, if you have some sort of initial fluctuations at the surface of last scattering and you just let particles move straight, you know, if this is a lens, like for example, water waves in a swimming pool and you're looking down, you might see something like this. This also looks a lot like the cosmic web. And there's this really beautiful paper by Zadovich and Shenderin that explores this analogy with geometric optics in much more depth. And so if you just run an n-body simulation on the right-hand side, and you run the Zadovich approximation with exactly the same initial conditions, this takes about a few seconds to run on a laptop. This takes a few hours to run on a supercomputer. You can see that they actually look extremely, extremely, extremely similar by eye. If you quantify this cross-correlation coefficient, you can see that for this, for the fully nonlinear case of the Zadovich approximation, this is very large out to k of one, whereas linear theory really breaks down super quickly. If you remember that you're subtracting your variance by this quantity squared, you basically have what seems to be almost an infinite amount of reduction of variance by applying this technique. So we asked this question of how powerful is this control variate, and I'm just going to very quickly go through the slides, but I'm happy to talk to you more about this in detail. Basically, we find that for the power spectrum, we can reduce the error bars by a factor of almost 200 at the largest scales that we measure them in the simulation. So the variance is reduced by this squared. So this is, like almost a 40,000-fold reduction in the variance. This even lets you do things such as measure a power spectrum in a simulation and then just take the Fourier transform of this, which to get the correlation function, which you should never do as a measurement of a correlation function. But you actually get this orange curve, which is extremely, extremely, extremely well measured. This is a gigaparsec box out to separations that compare to literally half of the size of the box. We also show that this works for all of those basis spectra in hybrid EFT. The reductions in variance are about 100-fold. So this is like averaging hundreds of simulations together. For every single one of these, some of these reductions get as dramatic as about a million-fold reduction in variance. We recently, with Joe and Steven, also showed that this works in redshift space as well. And so this picture of combining n-body simulations and perturbation theory, sorry, surrogate n-body simulations that look like just simple perturbation theory is really powerful. You can design emulators with significantly smaller boxes, You can more efficiently explore, for example, nonlinear beyond lambda CDM phenomena using this technique because you don't have crazy computational requirements now. You can make mock surveys, which are very popular for like covariance matrix validation or analysis tool validation, using significantly smaller volumes. And this technique, which I haven't been able to stress enough maybe, is really, really, really cheap. It's like 50 CPU hours for a box, which is nothing. It's just running an initial conditions code a single times and doing a bunch of Fourier transforms. And you know, we can actually think that we can extend this to other summary statistics like the bispectrum or the covariance matrix of the power spectrum, which we're looking at right now. So I'm at 59 minutes and 50 seconds, so maybe it's a good time to wrap up. Modern cosmological inference, hopefully I've convinced you, is challenging on many, many, many fronts. But over the last few years, as I've been sort of looking at this meeting of pencil and paper and supercomputing, I've found it to be a really powerful lens through which to think about the formation of large-scale structures. And I think these techniques in the future are really exciting as a paradigm. I think we're going to have state-of-the-art models for galaxy clustering and their cross-correlations with lensing surveys to smaller scales than we could ever do before. I think we can make finally really accurate models for analysis beyond the two-point paradigm. I think we can characterize the galaxy-halo connection at very high precision, including looking at these really complicated primordial non-Gaussianity responses. You know, if you're really interested in simulation-based models, these techniques for variance reduction are really, really, really promising. And you know, this is just what we've managed to do so far. I think there are a lot of other things that we can do in the future. So thank you for having me. I'm happy to take more questions, but I know we're sort of out of time. But
it's for a few minutes over. Let's just try to do a couple of quick questions. So
something has been bugging me since you wrote those on the board. So there is no one-to-one correspondence between a displacement field and a density, because you could have things that don't change the density, but like rotations, they don't change the density, but they give you a displacement. So I'm confused by that. I feel we need some extra information about correlators and displacement that's not just included in the density.
So in the single stream picture of structure formation, the Eulerian matter density is just given basically precisely by integrating this delta function of the particle positions, which is sort of the Lagrangian Eulerian correspondence. So this is like that Jacobian that becomes singular when you have shell crossing. So I think here you can describe the Eulerian picture exactly just through these displacements, right? Because,
if you have displacement, you can get the densities.
Yeah.
So if you have all the information about displacements, you have everything you need. But that's not what you're doing. The stuff with delta, which is not the same. So I think there's some information in displacement that's not delta.
So what we're looking at then is basically, if we expand this to tracers, can you see because of the?
That's okay.
You can push it up.
So if we go to tracers now, the basic claim that people make for biasing in Lagrangian theory is that this same advection integral holds, but now instead of just moving particles completely unweighed, you're weighing them by this Hessian. But this sort of still holds exactly. So I think, which basically this comes out of number density conservation of these tracers, which is a little bit iffy if you have mergers and things like that. But for large scales where you're doing the smoothing to form this effective theory, I think it works okay.
Okay, so I guess we can talk about it more, but just one quick question. Can you know this all be done in Eulerian instead of doing just the bias and everything that's Eulerian?
Yeah, good. So part of the problem, people sort of, in a sense, have done this in Eulerian. What the n-body simulations really solve for, a lot of them are particle-based and Lagrangian in nature. And so when you try to do this Lagrangian to Eulerian conversion and make the like late-time Eulerian fields and then expand on that, they're really sensitive to like the smoothing scale and to the UV and to all of that sort of stuff. So like if you write down this delta squared bias in Eulerian, right, it's a convolution, and you're picking up an infinite contribution basically from the very small scale modes that are very nonlinear.
Okay.
When you write this delta squared in Lagrangian, the UV contribution is actually quite small because the transfer function is really damped at high k for linear theory.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I have a question in the chat.
Yeah, so this is a very introduction that you discussed. So, do I understand correctly that it requires Gaussian statistics? Or not necessarily?
No, sorry. Why would it? It holds for any statistic in principle, it holds for any statistic, right? It's this very general expression here. So if you have the bispectrum here, for example, and the model for the surrogate of the bispectrum, you can still build this estimator, and it should still be unbiased, I think. Now,
the variance shouldn't it be Gaussian? The variance that you are using, well, basically this cosmic variance, should it be Gaussian or not necessarily? Well, basically the variance of this F and Y.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be. I can go back and check the statistics textbooks, but people do this very often in Monte Carlo theory, where you have very, very, very non-Gaussian distributions that you're trying to approximate. So I don't think it's true. I think this holds even for very non-Gaussian things.
I see. And still the estimator is unbiased, your claim.
Yes, yes. Now, of course, if you're using Monte Carlo for your estimate of mu, like then when you take the error of this y, you know, you have some contribution that relates to the statistical uncertainty on this mu, and so this is what kills a lot of these analyses that DESI use. That's why they need 24 million CPU hours, is to measure mu to very high precision.
I see. Thank you, yeah.
One last question for Matt.
So how much worse do you do in the first part of the talk instead of using it to use the solid approximation?
Yeah. Yeah. So when we use only the dashed lines in the first part of my talk, which were those one loop calculations, these are looking at actually beyond Zhodovich corrections, where we have the linear displacement, which is Zhodovich, the second order displacement, which people call 2LPT, and then the 3LPT, and all of those together. And that's what we get from those dashed lines. So it's actually still not enough, and you really need the full n-body result to do well. You can go to k of 0.2, which is what we did in this analysis, for example. So this uses only perturbation, only analytic LPT to get to this result. But past these scales, this starts to break down. And maybe a quick comparison is that for the power spectrum, you can see the deviations between the Zhodovich prediction and the n-body result already at k of, you know, 0.3 in a log-log plot, you can tell this is different, and so that means it's like a factor of a few, probably.
Thanks.
Okay, let's thank Ben again for a very interesting talk.